Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Okay. We're trying to make some adjustments here. Okay.
Well, hey folks, and welcome to Solar Cabin Channel. I've got a neat little project for you. I call the Multi-Shack. This is one of my homeless housing solutions designs. And some of you probably don't know this, but I was homeless twice in my life. The first time was when I was trying to get into college, and I had lost my job and was waiting for my college funding to come in. And so I had to live in my truck. I lived in the cab of my truck for almost 2 months while I waited for my college funding to come in. And then again later in life when I got divorced and didn't have a job and was trying to get off grid, I lived for almost 2 years in a camp trailer. And you know, there's a lot of people that homeless people that have their pride. They want to maintain their independence. They don't want to live on welfare. They don't want to be caught up in the system. And you know, all they need is a simple shelter. You know, someplace to get out of the cold, to get out of the wind, to get out of the rain, while they get back on their feet. And so I know there's a lot of organizations out there that are helping the homeless, churches, nonprofits, and things like that. So I came up with this small structure design, which I call the multi-shack, because it has actually multi-uses to it, and it can be built very affordably. You can build this entire shack for under $200, and it is built on wheels. It can be put on either a 4x6 trailer, or you can build it on casters. Casters are a lot less expensive, but it still allows you to move this unit around. So you could store, you know, a bunch of these on a church parking lot, and then just when you need them, you can move them out to wherever you want the person to be using them. Casters are 4-inch casters. Each caster will hold up to 240 pounds, so they'll more than handle the weight for this structure here. Now, this structure is 6'5" from the peak to the bottom, 6'5", so and even a tall person can stand upright inside this structure. The door is 1'6" wide and about 5'3" to the peak up there in the door. And the structure is 4 foot wide approximately and about 6 foot long. About 6 foot long by 4 foot wide, 6'5" to the peak. And this is constructed very inexpensively from 2x4 framing, which I'll show you, and uses, I would use 7/16 OSB or plywood. Either one would work for the siding on this. Now, a couple of the features here. I show this with dorm windows. The dorm windows are actually optional. You don't have to put dorm windows. You can just go with a flat roof surface if you want here. I show this with wood shingles, or you could use just plain old tar paper and roofing shingles. Any type of roofing shingles would work on this. Show it with a little flower box there just for effect. And on the backs and the front, I show this with these round windows, like boat-style windows, or you could put square windows. Either one works. I just like the effect of the round windows, the look of those in there. This does have an access panel on the back. Down here is an access panel. We'll just open this up so I can show you. Open up, take this one off. There we go. Now you can see inside the access panel. Underneath the seat and bed is storage, lots of storage underneath here for a propane tank, one of those Port-a-Loo porta-potties, an ice chest over there you can see. Okay, so there's good storage. This is about 18 inches high inside here and about 4 feet wide inside. So the structure, I'll show this with the door open. Let me just hide this door here. With the door open, you can see I've got this set up. Right now I've got it set up for seating. During the day, this would be used for seating purposes, okay? And I'm going to pull the side roof off here so I can show you inside. But this has a very nice space for a person that maybe is going to school or working, or just the table can be used for eating or whatever. So you've got approximately 6 feet of space on the inside here by 4 feet wide. And this table is actually part of the bed platform, which I'll show you. You just pull the 2x4 out, put it in one of these slots. It's in this 2x4 here. There's another one on the other side. You just drop the 2x4 into the slot, and then you take your bed panel and put it up on top of that, and then that becomes a table. Here you've got 2 foot by 4 foot cushions. There's three of these cushions that become your bed, or you can use a roll-up mattress pad underneath this that becomes your bed. But during the daytime, it becomes seating. It becomes a little mini couch in here, 4 foot wide. And now you've got a space for a student to do their studies, their work, or for having your meal, or if you're working on a hobby or a craft or something like that, you've got this nice little space. When you get out the door, you just lift the table up, put it back, put the 2x4 back in the bottom slots, put the table down, and you know, then you turn it into a bed. And I'm going to show you what it looks like as a bed, too. So, good headroom in this. I really like that it's got a very good space. This is an average person, 5'8" tall. You can see you've got lots of headroom here. You've got these nice dormer windows, which would give you lots of light. Lots of light, and also gives you a little bit more headroom up in this area right in here. A 6 foot person could stand up in the middle of this quite comfortably. Two people could actually share, sit side by side on this couch, or you can put in another, you could pull your ice chest cooler out, or someone could put a foldable chair on the other side here. So you could actually have two people sitting side by side or crossways next to each other here. So lots of space in this little place. So let me show you what the framing looks like on this first. And I'll just have to zoom in on this. Now this is all done with 2x4 construction to keep it inexpensive and easy to build. And then I would sheathe it with either 7/16 inch OSB or plywood. Either one would work. Now it's got a floor frame, as you can see, made of 2x4s down here. Simple 2x4 frame, floor frame construction, and then your casters attach to the corners, not exactly in the corners, but they attach to the floor framing, and the casters have locks on them, so once you move this in place, you can just click on the locks and lock it in place so it won't be rolled around while the person is inside it. Now, this is the bed platform, and it has, this back platform is 2 foot 6 inches wide, and it is permanently connected. These are 1 foot 9 inch wide platforms that can be raised up. And as you can see, these 2x4s right here, you put the 2x4 up in these other slots, and then you put these panels up on top, and they become either a table or workspace. This one can go up here. This one can go on the end. It can go over the middle. So I gave you lots of options for the ways that you can organize this into workspace or living space as you need to use it. Very simple construction. Takes about 20 2x4s to build this. That's about it. And you're looking at about under $200 for all the material costs. And you could build one of these in a day. Seriously, you could build the complete unit in about a day. And now I'm going to show you on the inside how this can be used as a bed and also as a small business. So I'm just going to click off this. Okay, now I show this with the bed down, the door open so you can kind of get a peek inside here. Now, this is an uninsulated structure. You really don't need insulation in a small structure like this because the human body puts off about as much heat as a 90-watt light bulb. So in a small structure like this, your own body heat will actually heat it up. And for sleeping, you can either do these pads like this as mattress pads, or you can just get a sleeping bag pad or even an air cushion pad to go underneath it. A sleeping bag pad would work fine because you can roll it up and use it as your seating. And a good heavy-duty sleeping bag would be all you would need in order to sleep very comfortably in here. As long as you don't have the wind blowing on you or the rain drenching you or snow piling up on you, you'll sleep very comfortably in a small structure like this. Your own body heat will heat it up. You could add a heater to these, but it really isn't necessary in these small structures. So I'm going to pull off the side roof, and I'm going to show you how much space this has inside it for a bed. It actually has a very nice bed that will sleep either one or two people. Pull this off here. Just hide this. Now, this has a 4 foot wide by 6 foot long bed. So even an average person can sleep in here. Even a tall person, fairly tall person, could sleep in here comfortably without being cramped. And it's 4 foot wide, so that's a very wide bed that will actually sleep two people. Two people could sleep in this space, all right? And it's 6 foot wide, and it's 4 foot wide and 6 foot long. This person I show in here is about 5 foot 8 inches tall, which is average height for most people. And here you can see the slots I was talking about. These platforms, which I'll show you, I'll take the bed off now. These two platforms are removable with 2x4s underneath them. You just take the 2x4, you put it in the slots that go across here, and then put these platforms up on top to make your table. And you can actually do a table on either end, or one in the middle for a desk and table. Now, the ones on the ends I'll show you are used if you want to run a small business out of here, or if you want to organize this in a different way so that if you're cooking, you could put one of these tables on this end or on this end, and you could set up your cooking supplies, and you can take care of yourself. You can cook a meal inside this little place right here. So 4 foot wide, 6 foot long bed, and then very adaptable with these platforms of 2x4s. You can just put them up, and you can reorganize this any way you want during the daytime for whatever function that you're going to be using. Again, it has storage space underneath the bed. And seating. You've got that nice access panel for you. You've got storage underneath there. And I really like the space in here. This would be enough adequate space if in an emergency, let's say that a city has a disaster, a fire like they just had in Canada wipes out all these homes, or you have a tornado tear through a place, or you have flooding or something like that, which we've all seen in the news happens all the time, and suddenly churches are overrun with people that don't have housing. You know, if you had a bunch of these sitting around that would sleep at least two people, you could pull these out in a small area. You could set these up and people would at least have shelter for, you know, survival until they can get into houses or bigger shelters or something like that. So that's another use for this type of structure here. So now I'm going to put the bed back on just to show you. And again, you can see this has really nice dormer windows. So you got really good light in this. And it's got an excellent sleeping space. It would be better for one person, but it would be adequate for two people. Okay? And, you know, if you got little teeny kids with you, you could put, you know, one adult and a couple of kids in there, too. You know, there's enough space in there to sleep comfortably, and you've got lots and lots of headroom. You're not going to bump your head or anything while you're sleeping. Doorway, 1 foot 6 inches wide, 5 foot 3 inches to the top up here. So lots and lots of good space in this. Now I'm going to show you how this can also be modified to be used as a small business. Okay, one thing I know about people that are homeless is they're also very creative. And, you know, a lot of them actually run little businesses in order to support themselves. A lot of them do recycling. They recycle cans and bottles and other stuff like that. Or they pick up small appliances and stuff that they may find on the streets, or books or pictures or whatever, and they resell them, and that's how they support themselves. A lot of them are also very crafty people. They may make jewelry, or they may make wood crafts or something like that, or they may be artists. And so they have a way to support themselves, and so I think we ought to encourage that, because that helps them to develop sustainability. Not everybody is equipped to work in the regular workforce. Some people just aren't, but they're very industrious and can support themselves with a small business. And so I thought, well, this shack could also be used for setting up a small business. So what I did is I made this so that the window here can be hinged up, and I'll show this. The window on the one of the dormers, or both, can be hinged up out of the way. And then you've got room here to put a sales counter or little platform here where this person is 5 foot 8 inches tall. A person can stand in this window and they can operate a small business. They can talk to customers, they can take money or whatever, working right out of this small shack. Now, this doesn't necessarily have to be for homeless people. If you wanted to run a hot dog or hamburger stand, or sell your crafts or your books, or, you know, whatever you want to do with this, maybe it's a ticket stand, I don't know. This little shack could be very useful for a lot of different purposes. That's why I call it a multi-shack, is because it can be used for many different purposes. But this would be great for a homeless person that has a craft that they make, or recycle products or whatever. They want to sell them, they just hinge up the window, and they set themselves up a little business here to take care of customers. Now, this also shows inside how those tables can be reorganized. Here you can see I've lifted up the bed platform to put a table on this end, another table on this end, and you can use this for cooking in here. You can see I've got a little two-burner propane stove that you can set up on one of the tables up there, so you can do your cooking. You can work on your crafts. This table just lifts off, a 2x4 lifts off if you need to get access to the door. Lots of good headroom, okay? Workspace in there. This can be modified many different ways for many different people of however you want to use it. So a very functional space in there. All right, so that is the multi-shack, all right? And let me just then hide this so you can get a better view of it. Again, can be built very inexpensively. Around under $200 on casters, more expensive if you put it on a trailer. And I'm going to provide these plans for free because this is a project that I designed specifically for churches and nonprofit organizations to build shelters. And at present in the U.S., we have about 1.6 million homeless people. that just need a simple shelter to live in, or we have that's about 1 out of 200 people, and that's just in the U.S. There's a lot of people in other countries that are in even worse shape, and I really think a project like this would be great for helping the homeless people to have shelter while maintaining their independence and their pride. But it could also be used as disaster relief shelters. You know, there, we could easily have a major disaster in a city where we have thousands and thousands of people that suddenly are homeless, and we need to provide quick shelter. These would also work for that. It would be big enough space for two people to sleep and, you know, to take care of their basic needs, and that's what this structure is about. So I hope you like this design. It's called the Multi-Shack. You can get the plans for free on my website, simplesolarhomesteading.com. Up at the top, look at Multi-Shack. Now, there is a button there if you would like to donate. Your donations are used by me to design structures like this and build small houses. I work with a lot of homeless people that don't want to be in the system, that want to build their own off-grid cabins and houses and places like that. I help them with designs and building those projects. So any donation, if you can donate, is very appreciated and will help with those projects. All right, folks, I hope you like this project called the Multi-Shack, and have a great day.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. he'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
My name is Kelvin Krushank Odate. My African dream is the KJOB since 2020. I saw a moving plane passing by and something told me to build a plane. So from that day, I started building an airplane. It led to a stage. When it reached to the stage, how I want the airplane to fly, I couldn't have it like that. So I decided to build a car. Then I started building a car.
Imagine living in a space that measures a mere 168 square feet, more than 14 times smaller than the average American home. Well, it is here inside this tiny house where the proud owners are discovering that less is so much more.
Well, in the past year, we've managed to save everything that I earn. We use my husband's income for our living expenses, and I've been teaching public school, so that's about $3,000 a month that we've put in the bank this year.
Hari, her husband Carl, and their two young kids, Archer and Ella, recently celebrated their one-year anniversary in their tiny house. After losing their 1,500-square-foot home to financial struggles, the couple took matters into their own hands, literally. They built this space themselves with just $13,000 in materials. Their goal? To become debt-free and save enough to one day build a new home, mortgage-free. And so far, they're right on track.
Things are going really well with the next project. We're going to build a 16 by 24 unit to begin with, and then we'll branch off of that and add bedrooms.
You may remember seeing this family on The Anderson Show earlier this year, where I joined them on stage. Fascinated by their story, our financially fit team flew down to Virginia to see for ourselves and learn ways we can all downsize.
How are you?
Thanks.
Really good.
Thank you. Hey there. Living in the tiny house has taught me that we don't need much at all to be happy, and that getting the things that we need can actually be a lot of fun.
Can you get me a bowl and some scissors?
The family's fruit and vegetable garden lets them eat healthier, cut down on their carbon footprint, and slash their grocery bill by as much as 30%. Hari has also been upcycling, as she calls it, taking something old and breathing new life into it.
My favorite upcycling project was the rugs I made for the house. I took old sheets, flat sheets, and crocheted them into rugs. They're beautiful, and they fit the house a lot nicer than if we had gone and bought something new from the store.
The couple also recently switched jobs, not for more money, but more happiness. Carl is enjoying better working conditions at a new restaurant, and Hari left teaching to pursue a career in nonprofit. Being able to afford a career that you love and pursuing a passion rather than a paycheck, they've learned, is just an added benefit to having savings and no debt.
I'm probably taking a 25 to 30% cut in my salary, which is going to enable me to have more time to actually build the house and save money because I'll be the contractor.
It's really a great feeling to be able to make a decision like that, not based on money, but based on what we want to be doing with our time.
The kids also seem keen to the transition. Mom and Dad are happy to report fewer requests for video games or toys now that Ella and Archer are busy playing outdoors on their 3-acre property.
We play down by the creek and up at the big tree up there where the swing is. We play with our neighbors and ride bikes.
There's a lot of different things they can do with their time besides play with plastic toys and get online.
They've really just embraced it wholeheartedly. You can't stop them from having a good time outside.
Still another lesson, when you downsize, it helps to have a support system.
There's such a wealth of knowledge in our community, and that helps us a lot. And having that support makes it like we're doing it together. Moving to the country has given us a lot of things, not just the tiny house.
So, what do you think? What are your thoughts about living in a tiny house? Would you ever do it? Connect with me on Twitter at Farnoosh and use the hashtag FinFit. For Yahoo Finance, I'm Farnoosh Tarabi.
Ooh, it's a whole lot to unpack with Tim Norman, child. This Tim Norman situation, I don't even know what to say. If y'all have been under a rock News broke yesterday that Tim Norman, the son of Miss Robbie over at Sweetie Pies, had been arrested on federal charges stemming from the 2016 murder of his nephew, 18-year-old Andre Montgomery. A lot of this played out on the show, Sweetie Pies. Tim Norman and his mom had actually went to the location where the nephew had been shot, you know, on the show. People are now on that clip online. Like, let me go look and see what they saying on this clip. Hold on. Online on this clip, they was like dragging him on the Sweetie Pies clip. Sweetie Pies, hold on. It is right here. And they want y'all to know, honey, that they see Tim. They knew something was up with Tim. They're saying all kinds of things. We're going to talk about the story in a second, but I just wanted to be nosy real quick. The people in the comment section saying that dude is what a definition of a snake, a devil, and then go back to the scene with his mom. They said sometimes it'd be your own family, and to think Tim is the reason why Andre is dead. Wow. So everybody over there looking at the clip, because this clip came out in 2016, and they were actually at the site, the location where he was shot in St. Louis. And it's just interesting. So the story goes, let me put his picture back up. That, and that's his mugshot. He's smiling in his mugshot. He's been investigated ever since it happened. There's a stripper involved. A stripper arrived in, let me just read it, child, because I can't go by memory. There's too much going on in this damn news. James Timothy Norman's reality TV show storyline often features his search for redemption from a violent past. So Tuesday's news of his alleged murder-for-hire plot shook viewers who watched him mourn the death he is now accused of facilitating. Norman, 41, was a star on Welcome to Sweetie Pies, a reality show that ran for 5 seasons on OWN and highlighted Sweetie Pies, a new St. Louis area soul food business owned by Norman's mother, Robbie Montgomery. Norman was arrested Tuesday and accused in federal court of orchestrating the shooting death of his 21-year-old nephew, Andre Montgomery Jr. The nephew, who also appeared on the show, was Robbie Montgomery's grandson. Federal authorities say Norman hired Terica Ellis, a former St. Louis County resident who was working in Memphis, Tennessee as an exotic dancer, to help in the March 2016 killing near Fairground Park. Prosecutors say Norman then attempted to collect on the life insurance benefits of his nephew's death. On Wednesday, past TV clips of Norman's reaction to his nephew's death circulated online. Norman had visited the scene, which we just watched, of the killing with his mother, along with TV cameras for a 2016 episode. During that episode, he said, since Andre's passing, I haven't gone through that part of the city. Really, I've been avoiding it. The 21-year-old was killed the 3900 block of Natural Bridge Avenue, not far from where his father was killed shortly before Norman's birth. Wow. Robbie Montgomery's nephew was also shot and killed nearby. Norman, in a later episode, sat a few seats from his mother as she was interviewed about her grandson's killer. So the timeline of events is as follows. Prosecutors say that Tim Norman, took out a $450,000 life insurance policy on his nephew, Andre Montgomery Jr. in 2014, making himself the sole beneficiary of said policy. Whew, it's always money, huh? It's always about the money. Hold on, let me go back. He also made false statements about his nephew's income and family history in the policy documents. Montgomery was 18 when Norman took out the policy, but he said he had a family and he was married. Montgomery had been featured on the show 1 year earlier, graduating from McClure North High School. The show documented the teen's transition, moving from Texas to live with his grandmother near St. Louis so she could help him get through school. In March 2016, Norman had moved to Los Angeles near a new restaurant he owned in Inglewood. Early in the morning, the day his nephew was killed, Norman arrived in St. Louis by plane and booked a room at the Chase Park Hotel, according to court documents. By 1 p.m. that day, two burner phones, prosecutors say were used by Ellis and Norman, were activated in St. Louis. Court documents claim that at 7 p.m. that night, Montgomery texted Ellis the address of the recording studio where Montgomery, an aspiring rapper, was working. At about an hour later, he was shot at the same location. After receiving Montgomery's text, prosecutors say Ellis immediately called Norman. Witnesses told police that Montgomery took a call just before 8 p.m. that night and went outside to meet someone. Honey, they've been watching them a long time. A review of his phone records showed police that Montgomery spoke to two people in the 10 minutes before he was shot. Ellis and one other friend. So he had talked to the stripper girl and one other friend. Prosecutors say Ellis was saved in Montgomery's phone under her stage name and Instagram handle, Alexis the Great. Ellis's phone data also put her at the scene of the crime, according to the documents. And despite being at the scene of Montgomery's murder at 8.02 p.m., the documents state that Ellis' call was not to police, but she called Tim Norman at 8.03 p.m. Prosecutors say location data show Ellis then drove away from the scene and headed back to Memphis, Tennessee. The burner phones were turned off the next day and never used again. Over the next few days, Ellis deposited more than $9,000 in cash into several bank accounts. A week after the death, Norman contacted a life insurance company and attempted to collect on his nephew's policy, but he never received the money because of lack of documentation. Oh, wow, it's a whole lot. Norman was upfront about his criminal past, blah, 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 after describing the difficulty in rebuilding a life after spending 10 years in prison as a teen. Norman was 17 and a senior at Hazelwood Central High School in 1997 when he and another teen were charged with a series of felonies. So Norman, you know, he has his own struggles. A lot of people have been hitting me up in my DM, said that, you know, it's rumor around St. Louis that, you know, he had allegedly, you know, molested the nephew when he was young, and the nephew was going to tell, and it was all kind of stuff that's going on. So we'll never know what the complete story is, and I'm sure there will be more details. Oh, it's a lot. It's a whole lot. You said for the love of money, prepaid, child. Y'all talk about Tim and them hips. Like, we always knew something was wrong. We always knew something was wrong. Let me finish looking at this article, seeing what else they got in here. It's a whole lot in this article. Tim's mother sued him back in June 2016, claiming his operation of Three Sweetie Pies restaurants was a copyright infringement. So Norman wanted to expand the business into a national chain, but he eventually had to close several locations. Now, that's interesting because in this, you know, in my DM, they were saying that they feel like the mom was part of the investigation because apparently the nephew had confided in the mom. And this is just word on the street, so I don't know. I don't know. In April 2017, Norman was charged with misdemeanor assault at a Houston's restaurant located that has since closed. A former chef at the restaurant accused Norman of punching him in the face when the chef asked him about paychecks for other employees. That case is ongoing. Norman was living in Jackson, Mississippi, where he co-owns another Sweetie Pies location at the time of his arrest. He faces a charge of conspiracy to use interstate commerce facilities in commission of a murder for hire. Now, let's talk about Terica for a minute. Here's her mugshot because she got arrested also. Terica is the exotic dancer that, you know, was in the phone, and they traced her phone to the location. So prosecutors will not say how Ellis and Norman met, how Terica met the nephew, but court records show that Ellis lived for a time in St. Louis. Ellis was living in Florissant in 2010, according to court documents tied to a landlord dispute. Court documents say she later moved to Memphis, but would occasionally return to visit the St. Louis area. Court documents also show Ellis has two misdemeanor convictions from 2006 to 2007. One is an indecent exposure charge connected to her employment at the time at the Pure Passion Strip Club in Memphis. The other is a drug possession offense. Ellis was arrested in July and faces the same conspiracy to murder for higher charge as Norman. So she's been locked up a little longer than he has. So I guess, you know, she provided more details to the case. Oh, I didn't even put the picture in there. Miss Robbie was teaching Andre the business. You said Pure Passion. You was at, you know what Pure Passion is, John John? You been there. You been in that strip club. Never trust a man with childbearing. She only got $9,000 to ruin her life, child. It sounds like something that'll be on one of those on TV shows, the ID Network, late at night. I don't know what's going on. It's just unfortunate that, like, he would do that to his own family member. That means you don't give a damn about nobody. If he'll do that to his nephew, he'll do that to his mom. How many other people he got insurance policies on that he might be looking to cash in on? How many others?
We are taking action for some neighbors who are living a nightmare after squatters moved in on their block.
They've been sighted, even caught stealing electricity, but somehow they're still there.
And that is our Ronnie Dahl paying them a visit. She joins us live from Detroit's East Side with more squatter drama.
Now, this happened on Detroit's West Side, and police are calling this a home invasion. But some people are seeing it a little differently. The victim did not want to talk on camera, but a few family members of the suspects did. Last night, the lady of this house came home to one hell of a surprise. There was one heck of a party in her pad, but she never got the invite. Three men had helped themselves to all of her gin and her Seagram's Happy Juice. And these cats went crazy. They cooked up all her food, crab legs, shrimp. They even had a bird in the oven. Can you believe it? And while they were fixing their feast, they were high as a kite on the chronic. Bold, huh? She screamed.
And they ran out the house.
Then the lady called the law. According to the police report, the victim says her house was a hot mess. A bunch of her stuff was stolen, including some very sentimental things. And the dudes dining at her dining room table were fellas with familiar faces. She told detectives two of them live right next door. Now that's worse than a nosy neighbor.
Your brothers were in there.
Yeah, one of them.
But sis here says it's not his fault. He was just a guest.
Somebody was squatting in that house. The guy that was in there, he was squatting already, so he was inviting people over as if he was living there.
If you're a homeowner, renting a property or whatever, you don't leave your home abandoned for 3-4 months.
Well, the woman tells Fox 2, she was there last Tuesday, and everything was intact.
This is Detroit, Michigan. This is the hungry capital of the world, and we will come in there and squat in your house if you're not home.
It was like a chill spot.
Wait, what?
I mean, if you squat in the house, you... Somebody invites you over to smoke some weed, you're going to be right next door.
I don't know what you think about all this right now, but these people believe she's to blame, and she should have known better than to ever, ever leave her house alone for too long.
Stay on your property for your copper come up missing.
Now, that gentleman says he would never, ever do anything like that, but other people do. Two guys were arrested last night, but the other guy, he ran before the police got there. You know, the saddest thing about all this is you should be able to leave your house as long as you want to, and everybody should just leave it alone. By the way, that lady is looking for another place to live. I'm Andrea Isom on The Edge.
Hello, everybody. My name is Dr. Cartel, and welcome to another episode of Basic Nigerian History. By now, we have covered multiple different groups of people in the era that would eventually become Nigeria. But there's many more peoples left to cover. Unfortunately, I will not be covering each and every single one. Hence why this series is called Basic.
This is a time when the rich American soil seems to yield everything but a living for small farmers. The message is, get big or get out of farming. But a Tuskegee professor emeritus has a different row to hoe.
We take the small farmer out of the ballpark with the big guy. We tell him he can't grow no cotton and soybeans and beef cattle and hogs and wheat when the world market is setting the price of wheat. Now, if a farmer in Alabama is just growing soybeans and loses crop, it's a total disaster. You hear all this in media because like farming is a lifestyle. Well, you're not going to have much of a lifestyle in this country if you don't have some money.
While a professor at Tuskegee, Booker T. Watley experimented with farming on a small scale. He came up with a way to make a good living with a small operation. To a troubled farm community, Watley's plan was like rain at the end of a long dry spell. There were so many requests for information that he started a newsletter. Before long, he had some 20,000 subscribers here and in 21 foreign countries. The newsletter tells small farmers that if they're going to move forward, they're going to have to look back. Back to the idea of growing many crops rather than one or two. If one crop fails, there are others to keep the farm going.
Now this is a vine ripened tomato. The kind you don't get in the supermarket. Got thin skin. All the quality and flavor and taste is there. So. Delicious. You know, we have been led to believe that everything in the supermarket is fresh, and there's nothing in a supermarket that's fresh. And all we're trying to do is get the people back that appreciate quality in their fruits and vegetables.
Plenty of people are skeptical about small farms turning a profit, but Dr. Watley just points the naysayers down the road towards Auburn to Frank Randall's Pick Your Own Farm. Frank's 120 acres produce sheep, honey, grapes, blackberries, and blueberries. High-yield crops that don't need expensive equipment to plant or harvest. The farm is a working example of Watley's theory.
Get them picked?
Here it is.
Come harvest time, people find their way to the farm to pick fruit for next winter's breakfast cereal. According to Dr. Watley's plan, a pick-your-own harvest saves labor costs. But something else happens. Bringing people to the farm becomes more than a matter of dollars and cents.
That's gorgeous. And
look,
I picked them all.
Every one of them.
How about that?
We went into this thinking we were selling blueberries, thinking we were selling honey, thinking we were selling lamb. And we find that people are very much interested in letting their kids see where things come from and letting them see something growing. And so we've ended up selling an idea that that wasn't the intent at all, but that's what we've ended up doing. And it's worked out great. Frank, bring these right here. Own up. Close to the gate. Come on, sheep. Tighten them on up.
Well, you know, change is a funny thing. See, just like Frank's neighbors, every one of them except Frank grows cotton, corn, soybeans, wheat, and got some beef cattle. And all of them are in debt. And yet they won't change. They pay it right by Frank's house, and Frank don't owe anybody anything. Just like Frank's son is going to follow in his daddy's footsteps because he's going to know about the sheep, he's going to know about the bees, he's going to know about the blueberries. Well, those older farmers is following and doing exactly what their dad and granddaddy did. But they won't change.
My granddad had a farm 10 times more complicated than this. He never went to school, owned in slavery, but he had a head full of common sense. Frankie, blueberries look good.
Well, you were telling me about these black raspberries. Now what we should do,
we really need our land grant institutions to put in some variety trials of black raspberries because they're worth about twice as much.
Twice as much
as red.
Well, red's worth a lot.
Yeah,
twice as much. That sounds
just
good.
Like gold nuggets.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
it's the challenge to see if you can work with Mother Nature just a little bit more closely. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. To me, that's the fun part of it, because it's never the same. It's just like an athlete, you know, he pushes himself a little bit further just to see if he can do it. Sometimes that stretching is painful, but you don't grow unless you, you know, the old cliche, you know, no pain, no gain.
Up from Slavery, Chapter 10, A Harder Task Than Making Bricks Without Straw. From the very beginning at Tuskegee, I was determined to have the students do not only the agricultural and domestic work, but to have them erect their own buildings. My plan was to have them, while performing a service, taught the latest and best methods of labor, so that the school would not only get the benefit of their efforts, but the students themselves would be taught to see not only the utility in labor, but beauty and dignity. Would be taught, in fact, how to lift labor up from the mere drudgery and toil, and would learn to love work for its own sake. My plan was not to teach them the work in the old way, but to show them how to make the forces of nature, air, water, steam, electricity, horsepower, assist them in their labor. At first, many advised against the experiment of having the buildings erected by the labor of the students, but I was determined to stick to it. I told those who doubted the wisdom of the plan that I knew that our first buildings would not be so comfortable or so complete in their finish as buildings erected by the experienced hands of outside workmen, but that in the teaching of civilization, self-help, and self-reliance, the erection of the buildings by the students themselves would more than compensate for any lack of comfort or fine finish. I further told those who doubted the wisdom of the plan that the majority of our students came to us in poverty, from the cabins of the cotton, sugar, and rice plantations of the South. And that while I knew that it would please the students very much to place them at once in finely constructed buildings, I felt that it would be following out of more natural process of development to teach them how to construct their own buildings. Mistakes I knew would be made, but these mistakes would teach us valuable lessons for the future. During the now 19 years existence of the Tuskegee School, the plan of having the buildings erected by student labor has been adhered to. In this time, 40 buildings, counting small and large, have been built, and all except four are almost wholly the product of student labor. As an additional result, hundreds of men are now scattered throughout the South who receive their knowledge of mechanics while being taught how to erect these buildings. Skill and knowledge are now handed down from one set of students to another in this way, until at the present time, a building of any description or size can be constructed wholly by our instructors and students, from the drawing of the plans to the putting in of the electric fixtures, without going off the grounds for a single workman. Not a few times when a new student has been led into the temptation of marring the looks of some building by lead pencil marks or by the cuts of a jackknife, I have heard an old student remind him, "Don't do that. That is our building, and I helped to put it up." In the early days of the school, I think my most trying experience was in the matter of brick making. As soon as we got the farm work reasonably well started, we directed our next efforts toward the industry of making bricks. We needed these for use in connection with the erection of our own buildings, but there was also another reason for establishing this industry. There was no brickyard in the town, and in addition to our own needs, there was a demand for bricks in the general market. I had always sympathized with the children of Israel in their task of making bricks without straw, but ours was a task of making bricks with no money and no experience. In the first place, the work was hard and dirty, and it was difficult to get the students to help. When it came to brick making, their distaste for manual labor in connection with book education became especially manifest. It was not a pleasant task for one to stand in the mud pit for hours with the mud up to his knees, More than one man became disgusted and left the school. We tried several locations before we opened up a pit that furnished brick clay. I had always supposed that brick making was very simple, but I soon found out by bitter experience that it required special skill and knowledge, particularly in the burning of the bricks. After a good deal of effort, we molded about 25,000 bricks and put them into a kiln to be burned. This kiln turned out to be a failure because it was not properly constructed or properly burned. We began at once, however, on a second kiln. Now, this for some reason also proved a failure. The failure of this kiln made it still more difficult to get the students to take any part in the work. Several of the teachers, however, who had been trained in the industries at Hampton, volunteered their services, and in some way we succeeded in getting a third kiln ready for burning. Now, the burning of a kiln requires about a week. Toward the latter part of the week, when it seemed as if we were going to have a good many thousand bricks in a few hours, in the middle of the night, the kiln fell. For the third time, we had failed. The failure of this last kiln left me without a single dollar with which to make another experiment. Most of the teachers advised the abandoning of the effort to make bricks. In the midst of my troubles, I thought of a watch which had come into my possession years ago. I took this watch to the city of Montgomery, which was not far distant. I placed it in a pawn shop. I secured cash upon it to the amount of $15 with which to renew the brick-making experiment. I returned to Tuskegee, and with the help of the $15, rallied our rather demoralized and discouraged forces and began a fourth attempt to make bricks. This time, I am glad to say we were successful. Before I got a hold of any money, the time limit on the watch had expired, and I've never seen it since. But I have never regretted the loss of it. Brickmaking has now become such an important industry at the school that last season our students manufactured 1,200,000 of first-class bricks of a quality suitable to be sold in any market. Aside from this, the scores of young men have mastered the brickmaking trade, both the making of bricks by hand and by machinery, and are now engaged in the industry in many parts of the South. The making of these bricks taught me an important lesson in regard to the relations of the two races in the South. Many white people who had no contact with the school, and perhaps no sympathy with it, came to us to buy bricks because they found out that ours were good bricks. They discovered that we were supplying a real want in the community. The making of these bricks caused many of the white residents of the neighborhood to begin to feel that the education of the Negro was not making him worthless. But in educating our students, we were adding something to the wealth and comfort of the community. As the people of the neighborhood came to us to buy bricks, we got acquainted with them. They traded with us and we with them. Our business interests became intermingled. We had something which what they wanted. They had something which we wanted. This in a large measure helped to lay the foundation for the pleasant relations that have continued to exist between us and the white people in that section, and which now extended throughout the South. Wherever one of the brick makers has gone in the South, we find that he has something to contribute to the well-being of the community into which he has gone, something that has made the community feel that in a degree it is indebted to him, and perhaps to a certain extent dependent upon him. In this way, pleasant relations between the races have been stimulated. My experience is that there is something in human nature which always makes an individual recognize and reward merit, no matter under what color of skin merit is found. I have found, too, that it is the visible and tangible that goes a long ways in softening prejudices. The actual sight of a first-class house that a Negro has built is 10 times more potent than pages of discussion about a house that he ought to build, or perhaps could build. The same principle of industrial education has been carried out in the building of our own wagons, carts, and buggies from the first. We now own and use on our farm and about the school dozens of these vehicles, and every one of them has been built by the hands of the students. Aside from this, we help supply the local market with the vehicles. The supplying of them to the people in the community has had the same effect as the supplying of bricks, and a man who learns at Tuskegee to build and repair wagons and carts is regarded as a benefactor by both races in the community where he goes. The people with whom he lives and works are going to think twice before they part with such a man. The individual who can do something that the world wants done will, in the end, make his way regardless of his race. One man may go into the community prepared to supply the people there with an analysis of Greek sentences. The community may not at all that time be prepared for it or feel the need of Greek analysis, but it may feel its needs of bricks and houses and wagons. If the man can supply the need for those, then it will lead eventually to a demand for the first product, and with the demand will come the ability to appreciate it and to profit by it. About the time that we succeeded in burning our first kiln of bricks, we began facing in an emphasized form the objection of the students to being taught to work. By this time, it had gotten to be pretty well advertised throughout the state that every student who came to Tuskegee, no matter what his financial ability might be, must learn some industry. Quite a number of letters came from parents protesting against their children engaging in labor while they were in school. Other parents came to the school to protest in person. Most of the new students brought a written or verbal request from their parents to the effect that they wanted their children taught nothing but books. The more books, the larger they were, and the longer the titles printed upon them, the better pleased the students and their parents seemed to be. I gave little heed to those protests, except that I lost no opportunity to go into as many parts of the state as I could for the purpose of speaking to the parents and showing them that the value of industrial education. Besides, I talked to the students constantly on the subject. Notwithstanding the unpopularity of industrial work, the school continued to increase in numbers to such an extent that by the middle of the second year, there was an attendance of about 150, representing almost all parts of the state of Alabama, and including a few from other states. In the summer of 1882, Ms. Davidson and I both went north and engaged in the work of raising funds for the completion of our new building. On my way north, I stopped in New York to try to get a letter of recommendation from an officer of a missionary organization who had become somewhat acquainted with me a few years previous. This man was not only refused to give me the letter, but advised me most earnestly to go back home at once and not make an attempt to get money, for he was quite sure that I would never get more than enough to pay my traveling expenses. I thanked him for his advice and proceeded on my journey. The first place I went to the north was Northampton, Massachusetts, where I spent nearly a half day in looking for a colored family with whom I could board, never dreaming that any hotel would admit me. I was greatly surprised when I found that I would have no trouble in being accommodated at a hotel. We were successful in getting money enough so that on Thanksgiving Day of that year, we held our first service in the chapel of Porter Hall, although the building was not completed. In looking about for someone to preach the Thanksgiving sermon, I found one of the rarest men that it has ever been my privilege to know. This was Reverend Robert C. Bedford, a white man from Wisconsin, who was the pastor of a little colored congregational church in Montgomery, Alabama. Before going to Montgomery to look for someone to preach the sermon, I had never heard of Mr. Bedford, and he had never heard of me. He gladly consented to come to Tuskegee and hold a Thanksgiving service. It was the first service of the kind that the colored people there had ever observed, and what a deep interest they manifested in it. The sight of the new building made it a day of Thanksgiving for them, never to be forgotten. Mr. Bedford consented to become one of the trustees of the school, and in that capacity, and as a worker for it, he has been connected with it for 18 years. During this time, he has borne the school upon his heart night and day, and is never so happy as when he is performing some service, no matter how humble for it. He completely obliterates himself in everything and looks only for permission to serve where service is most disagreeable and where others would not be attracted. In all my relations with him, he has seemed to me to approach as nearly to the spirit of the master as almost any man I ever met. A little later, there came into the service of school another man, quite young at the time and fresh from Hampton, without whose service the school never could have become what it is, and this was Mr. Warren Logan, who now for 17 years has been the treasurer of the institute and the acting principal during my absence. He has always shown a degree of unselfishness and an amount of business tact, coupled with a clear judgment. that has kept the school in good condition, no matter how long I have been absent from it. During all the financial stress through which the school has passed, his patience and faith in our ultimate success have not left him. As soon as our first building was near enough to completion so that we could occupy a portion of it, which was nearly the middle of the second year of the school, we opened a boarding department. Students had begun coming from quite a distance and in such increasing numbers that we felt more and more that we were merely skimming over the surface and that we were not getting a hold of the students in their home life. We had nothing but the students and their appetites with which to begin a boarding department. No provision had been made in the new building for a kitchen and dining room, but we discovered that by digging out a large amount of earth from under the building, we could make a partially lighted basement room that could be used for a kitchen and a dining room. Again, I called on the students to volunteer for work, this time to assist in digging out the basement. This they did, and in a few weeks we had a place to cook and eat in, although it was very rough and uncomfortable. Anyone seeing the place now would never believe that it was once used for a dining room. The most serious problem, though, was to get the boarding department started off in running order. With nothing to do within the way of furniture and with no money with which to buy anything, the merchants in the town would let us have the food that we wanted on credit. In fact, in those early years, I was constantly embarrassed because people seemed to have more faith in me than I had in myself. It was pretty hard to cook, however, without stoves, and awkward to eat without dishes. At first, the cooking was done outdoors and in old-fashioned, primitive style in pots and skillets placed over a fire. Some of the carpenter's benches that had been used in the construction of the building were utilized for tables. As for dishes, there were too few to make it worthwhile to spend time in describing them. Not one connected with the boarding department seemed to have any idea that meals must be served at certain fixed and regular hours, and that was a source of great worry. Everything was so out of joint and so inconvenient that I feel safe in saying that there for the first 2 weeks, something was wrong at every meal. Either the meat was not done or we had been burnt, or the salt had been left out of the bread or the tea had been forgotten. Early one morning, I was standing near the dining room door listening to the complaints of the students. The complaints that morning were especially emphatic and numerous because the whole breakfast had been a failure. One of the girls who had failed to get any breakfast came out and went to the well to draw some water to drink to take the place of breakfast, which she had not been able to get. When she reached the well, she found that the rope was broken and that she could get no water. She turned from the well and said in the most discouraged tone, not knowing that I was where I could hear her, "We can't even get water to drink at this school." I think no one remark ever came so near discouraging me as that one. At another time when Mr. Bedford, whom I had already spoken of as one of our trustees and devoted friend of the institution, was visiting the school, he was given a bedroom immediately over the dining room. Early in the morning, he was awakened by a rather animated discussion between two boys in the dining room below. The discussion was over the question as to whose turn it was to use the coffee cup that morning. One boy won the case by proving that for 3 mornings, he had not had an opportunity to use the cup at all. But gradually, by patience and hard work, we brought order out of chaos, just as will be true of any problem if we stick to it with patience and wisdom and earnest effort. As I look back now over the part of our struggle, I'm glad that we had it. I'm glad that we endured all those discomforts and inconveniences. I'm glad that our students had to dig out the place for the kitchen and dining room. I'm glad that our first boarding place was in that dismal, ill-lighted, and damp basement. Had we started in a fine, attractive, convenient room, I fear we would have lost our heads and become stuck up. It means a great deal, I think, to start off on a foundation which one has made for oneself. When our old students return to Tuskegee now, as they often do, and go into our large, beautiful, well-ventilated, and well-lighted dining room, and see tempting, well-cooked food, largely grown by the students themselves, and see tables, neat tablecloths and napkins, and vases of flowers upon the tables, and hear singing birds, and note that each meal is observed exactly upon the minute, with no disorder, And with almost no complaint coming from the hundreds that now fill our dining room, they too often say to me that they were glad that we started as we did and built ourselves up over year by year by a slow and natural process of growth.
Because I used to observe that a lot of little shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do. And,
but we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you're driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build little shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and beg, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.